Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Most schools are back in session again following the annual summer break. The rest will reopen soon. So we thought it might be interesting to devote this show to the teaching of history in the schools, especially as to how it has changed as of late and how professional historians view those changes. The Organization of American Historians has played a leading role in all of this, and the organization recently issued a report on the subject. The principal figure in the writing of that report was our guest this week, Jacqueline Hall, professor of American history at the University of North Carolina and a past president of the OAH. Following my conversation with Professor Hall, James Sheehan, a professor of history at Stanford University, will join us to offer us his thoughts on how we learn from history. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at some items of historical interest in the news. During the month of August, Talking History took a break from its weekly production of new shows to air some of the best programs of the past year. During that time, however, one important bit of history in the news appeared that we decided we had to share with you. It relates to an event of August 1945, namely press coverage of the bombing of Hiroshima on August 6th and Nagasaki 3 days later. Various news agencies reported that carbon copies of stories written by a reporter, George Weller, the first reporter to visit Nagasaki following its bombing, had been found by his son in Weller's apartment in Rome. Weller, it seems, skirted American authorities to get into the city, but he nevertheless submitted his reports to military censors. The reports infuriated General Douglas MacArthur, head of the U.S. occupation of Japan, as he had designated the area as off-limits to reporters, and the reports were quashed. In a September 8, 1945 dispatch, Weller wrote of walking through the city, which he described as a wasteland of war, where he viewed firsthand and reported on in graphic detail the devastating effects not only of the explosion, but of what was then called Disease X, or radiation sickness. Weller, a Pulitzer Prize winner, died in 2002. And on a decidedly lighter note, it seems that majoring in history has its advantages in the job market, at least in England. According to an article in The Guardian Unlimited, two reports on the employability of history graduates published by the Higher Education Academy provide evidence that history majors can be found among the most successful people in Britain. David Nichols, author of the report, explained that a remarkable number have gone on to become the movers and shakers of modern-day Britain. By way of example, he pointed to Chancellor Gordon Brown and four other members of the cabinet, the head of MI6, numerous media figures, and CEOs of several of the UK's largest corporations. Those history graduates surveyed for the report explained that a history education helps with judgment, and at the top level, judgment counts more than knowledge. They noted that history majors are trained to read quickly and effectively, and to process large amounts of information, think deeply about a subject, develop cogent arguments, and communicate clearly. History may also attract a certain type of personality, namely people who are a bit skeptical, iconoclastic, ideas-oriented, warm and socially pushy as opposed to trusting, conservative, solution-oriented, and emotionally distant or shy. Prince Charles was a history major, but his views are not included in the report. When we return, I take up the subject of how U.S. history is taught in the schools with Jacqueline Hall. This is Talking History.
The morn is full of bird song and fall is in the air. My hands are folded on my desk, I sit straight in my chair. Today is my first day of school, I am not a dunce, and I've got my box of crayons and a bag of lunch. What did you learn in school today? My mother said to me. I learned about the Indians and Johnny Appleseed, the father of our country and the farmer in the dell, and pledged allegiance to a flag and lined up. stop at the bell.
This past year, the Executive Board of the Organization of American Historians commissioned a report on the teaching of American history in the nation's public schools. Our guest this week, Jacqueline Hall, was a principal figure in the preparation of that report, whose focus is reflected in its title, History, Democracy, and Citizenship, The Debate Over History's Role in Teaching Citizenship and Patriotism. Jacqueline Hall is a professor of American history at the University of North Carolina and past president of the OAH. Welcome, Jacqueline.
I'm glad to be here.
Great. The opening sentence of your report reads, "We're engaged in a national conversation about the role of history in furthering democracy and civic engagement." What are the major issues involved in that conversation?
Well, it depends on who's explaining them. I would say that the major issue has to do with whether or not the history that we're going to teach in the public schools is going to be history that's based on current research, whether scholars who do research on history are going to be involved in defining that content, or whether these questions are going to be decided as political questions and hashed out in state legislatures and based on very vague ideas of what facts people should know and what facts don't matter.
Well, the goal of one group seems to be to tie the teaching of history with furthering democracy and civic engagement. And in view of your sort of setting this up as we have whether we're going to go in the direction of current research or go in a more political direction, would it be fair to say that if we were to move or stay in the direction of research, this doesn't necessarily rule out the connection between teaching history and promoting citizenship and patriotism?
Absolutely not. I would say, though, that the connection between teaching history and promoting citizenship and patriotism depends on what kind of country you're living in. In an authoritarian regime, the connection is usually one in which the government seeks to control what people know about the past and make sure that people don't know about things that the government doesn't want them to know about. In a democracy, the point of teaching history is exactly to create citizens who have full knowledge of their country's history, the good and the bad, who have the tools to look critically at what their government is doing and what is going on in their society today, using an understanding of the past to inform their understanding of the present.
So we're really talking...
The goal in both is to create good citizens, but it depends on what kind of citizens, whether you want democratic citizens or passive citizens who will not question.
That's right. That's where I was going to go, and a point well taken. We're really talking about the difference between emphasizing an informed populace versus one that, on some level of rote memory, has a certain script committed to memory.
Right.
We must, I suppose, take up what is largely going to be an issue as we debate this, is that the current presidency, President George W. Bush and Congress, have both, in a way, raised the standard here and given us some new funding for history education. I'm pointing in particular to Senator Robert Byrd's example as launching his Teaching American History grant program, and even the White House with its We the People initiative. First of all, briefly, if you will, tell us about these programs, and then tell us whether you see these as advantages or are there liabilities involved. What's your take on it?
Well, the Teach American History grants actually were initiated during the Clinton administration and vastly expanded by the efforts of Senator Byrd. And the goal of those grants, they're administered through the Department of Education, and they encourage collaborations between university-based scholars and K-12 teachers. A fourth of $1 billion has already been given out in those grants. There's another $117 million, I believe, scheduled to be given out next year. This is a quite amazing infusion of funds into the goal of improving history education in our schools. The We the People initiative started in 2002. It's a little more amorphous, and it's more directly connected to the interests of a political party and a group of politicians. The most important thing it's done, though, is to provide more money, additional money, to the National Endowment for the Humanities, which the NEH, in turn, is funneling, again, into attempts to improve history education.
You made reference to political parties. Is there a liability here in government being involved in these programs?
Well, I think that these programs are all to the good. The Teach American History grants particularly have just been, I think, a wonderful thing. There were attempts in the beginning to infuse these grants with the animus of the so-called culture wars. My sense is that that hasn't really happened. The We the People program, I think that it has a lot of potential too. The one problem that I saw initially in the White House effort was that in the initial forums that were held at the White House, for example, initially no professional historians were involved. Later they were to a lesser extent. So I saw some of this basic problem that I pointed out at the beginning. But all in all, I think that this gives us a great opportunity.
Okay, fair enough. And I think that's generally where most historians stand, seeing positive value here. But lately, of course, some historians have been concerned about the fact that history has been left out of the No Child Left Behind Act, which tests certain areas for competency, math, science, and reading. And a group of historians are concerned that by leaving history out, it will end up encouraging the decline of our students' knowledge of history. Are you among that group, at least figuratively?
No, I'm not, or at least I'm ambivalent. I think this does go to the heart, though, of a very complicated problem. It is true that while, on the one hand, the federal government is trying to encourage the teaching of history, on the other hand, the federal government is also behind an effort of accountability and standards and high-stakes testing in which history is going to be marginalized because it's not one of the things that's being tested. And if teachers are under tremendous pressure to teach to the test and to teach only what is tested, then this is going to work very much against the goals of improving history education. At the same time, I would be very concerned to see history included in high-stakes testing in the current way that those tests are being administered.
Okay, fair enough. Let me lead you into a bit of a political thicket here. You can deal with it, I'm sure. You mentioned earlier about the absence of historians early on at the table and working through these programs. And I think one of the commonly cited reasons for that is because there's a certain distrust of the profession of what they call revisionist history, which is a common term bandied about. I'm not sure that we all agree on what that means, at least between the professionals and the people out there on the street, so to speak. Would you take a moment and explain for us how historians look at revisionist history?
This is one of those problematic terms that I think keeps us from understanding each other and from moving forward, and it's not a helpful term. The dichotomy that is set up by some interest groups between so-called traditional history and revisionist history assumes that there is some body of historical facts that used to be taught, that has traditionally been taught, and all we have to do is keep teaching those over and over again, and then our students will know those facts and they'll be good citizens and so on, versus what historians understand history, and that is as an ongoing attempt to understand the past that is constantly changing as we discover new evidence, ask new questions, come up with new perspectives as time passes, and are constantly updating our understanding of history. If I could just make a comparison, there have been, as you know, a great deal of controversy over the formation of national history standards. So we could talk about that if we wanted to. But at the same time that that was going on, national standards for the teaching of science were formulated. There was no such controversy. Nobody would say, we want our students to be taught science, but we don't want them to be taught what scientists have discovered over the past 10 or 20 years. We want them to be taught something that was traditionally understood as science at some point in the past.
Right. Well, let me use that because that's a good segue, and I would like to talk about these standards, because often when people talk about revisionist history, they label it political correctness, which has been one of the charges that have been used against any attempt that we've made to establish national standards or even state standards for the teaching of history. So speak to that a bit more, if you would.
Well, I'll have to say first that political incorrectness is my least favorite term. The only opposition I can think of to that is political correctness versus political incorrectness. I don't think anybody would be on that side. In any case, the debate over the national standards started over a decade ago when the National Endowment for the Humanities invited a very eminent historian, Gary Nash, to put together a group of K-12 teachers, parents, scholars, to try to come up with some general standards for teaching history throughout the country. And they did that, and those standards exist, and they've been very helpful to people who want to use voluntarily. But they ended up torpedoed by controversy over how many times George Washington was mentioned versus how many times Elizabeth Cady Stanton or Harriet Tubman was mentioned, and those kinds of conversations. Now, the debates as they're taking place today, however, are on the state level, and most states are trying to come up with some sort of state-level standard for how history should be taught. And there, the controversies are very complicated. They range from situations in which, again, at the state level, groups of teachers and scholars and parents have come together and worked out collaboratively general guidelines for teachers to use. That has happened in some places, but in other places, it has been, again, a political football in which governors, Minnesota is an example of this, where governors set up a committee of hand-picked people. They come up with standards which are very poorly thought out. And suddenly, I'm describing what happened in Minnesota, and this has happened elsewhere, although this was a particularly big controversy. Teachers and parents became aware of these standards after the fact, began to protest, alerted professors in the history department at the University of Minnesota. All of these people began to work together to critique the standards and try to modify them. They have been critiqued and modified, and they're better than they were, but they're still a hodgepodge. So that's a worst-case scenario. So this is a little bit like the high-stakes testing problem. I think that standards can be valuable, but they can also do more harm than good.
Interesting. Okay. Well, we only have a minute left, so let me just ask you one last question here, which you can address. And that has to do with sort of the common wisdom out there that school-age children's knowledge of history has worsened over the years. But I know there have been a couple studies out there, and you point to a couple of them, where the evidence doesn't seem to support that. Could you comment on that in concluding our conversation?
I don't think that it's true that there's been this terrible decline in so-called historical literacy. These surveys have been done periodically since 1917, and they usually come up with about the same percentage of people who can't answer factual questions over the telephone. Well, very few of us really could be called up on the telephone out of the blue and suddenly, on demand, come up with facts, I think. But the problem with these surveys and with the controversies then that they set off is that they really misunderstand how children learn and how people learn. You can drill all the facts in the world into a child's head. They'll retain very few of them unless they have some kind of framework to put them in, some kind of previous understanding that they can build on. And that's where well-informed, skilled teachers come in.
Great. Okay. Well, we're going to have to end it there, but it's been a pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Jacqueline Hall, professor of American history at the University of North Carolina, and one of the authors of History, Democracy, and Citizenship, The Debate Over History's Role in Teaching Citizenship and Patriotism, a report by the Organization of American Historians, which is available from the OAH at its website, www.oah.org. This is Talking History. Following up on my conversation with Jacqueline Hall, past president of the Organization of American Historians, for our site of the week, we decided to tell you about a resource, not exactly a site, but a valuable source of information nonetheless, produced by the OAH to assist history teachers in the classroom. That resource is the Magazine of History, published bimonthly by the OAH with generous support from the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History. The magazine is aimed at teachers, helping them to better understand and more effectively teach all aspects of American history. Each issue focuses on one topic or theme and includes articles written by leading historians. It also includes lesson plans, related historical documents, suggestions for further reading, internet resources, and regular columns on U.S. history in an international context titled America on the World Stage. For more information on this valuable resource, visit the Organization of American Historians website at oah.org. And finally, as promised, James Sheehan joins us to answer the question, how do we learn from history? Many of us study history for the sheer pleasure of it, but most would agree that it is also a useful subject for the direction it provides in our personal and public lives. Sheehan looks at what role the professional historian should play in this. He is Dickinson Professor in the Humanities and Professor of History at Stanford University. He has won 4 awards for outstanding teaching and authored 4 books, the most recent being Museum in the German Art World, From the End of the Old Regime to the Rise of Modernism, published by Oxford University Press in 2000.
In his inaugural lecture as Regius Professor of History at Cambridge, the great 19th century historian Lord Acton said that the science of politics is the one science that is deposited by the streams of history, like the grains of gold in the sand of a river. And the knowledge of the past, the record of truths revealed by experience, is eminently practical as an instrument of action and a power that goes to the making of the future. I suspect that few historians today share Acton's confidence that the facts about the past are as recognizable as grains of gold glittering in the sand, or that the truths of past experience can easily be deployed as instruments of action. But however professionally skeptical we may be about learning from the past, there is no doubt that people try to do it all the time. In our private lives, we constantly evoke history to convey moral and practical lessons about how to behave. And of course, historical lessons are part of every political discussion and debate. Historical analogies, comparisons, and metaphors are all around us. They are a source of collective wisdom on which we all rely. We could not live without them. It seems to me that professional historians have a responsibility to subject the alleged lessons of the past to sustained critical scrutiny. This means bringing to public discussions of history our discipline's traditional virtues, a strict adherence to open and transparent research methods, a commitment to examining as much of the relevant evidence as possible, even if it threatens our own interpretation, a critical approach to all our sources, and especially those that seem to confirm conventional wisdom, the struggle to overcome personal bias, a struggle that should be no less persistent because it is unavoidably imperfect, and, last but not least, the resolute refusal to believe something merely because we wish it to be true. I can think of nothing more politically useful and practically important than these habits of mind. Without them, what we extract from history will not be grains of wisdom, but the fool's gold, all too often offered as precious lessons from the past. What we learn from history depends entirely on how we do it.
You've been listening to James Sheehan, Dickison Professor in the Humanities and Professor of History at Stanford University. Sheehan's commentary was taken from his article, How Do We Learn from History?, that was published in the January 2005 issue of Perspectives, the newsletter of the American Historical Association, which Sheehan served as president. This is Talking History. And that's it for another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just send them to us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beatty, producer. Alex Smith, our studio engineer. We remind you that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that for more information on Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.
Going to the fair, Simple Simon met a fireman. Going to the fair, said Simple Simon to the fireman, let me chase your wife. Peter, little Peter, was a pumpkin eater. Peter, Peter, pumpkin eater, had a wife and couldn't keep her. Put her in a pumpkin shell that he kept her very well. Rang around the roses, pocket full of poses. Ride, Sally, ride, wipe your weeping eyes. Little Sally Walker, sitting in the saucer. Turn to the east, turn to the west. Little Sally Walker, sitting in the saucer. Turn to the one and have a little fun. Go in and out the window, go in and out the window.